We are here to hear oral argument in the case of Webster versus Caraway, number 141049. And Mr. Wells, we will begin with you.
May it please the court, counsel, Stephen Wells on behalf of appellant Bruce Webster. I'm assisted at counsel table by Kirsten Schubert. And I do want to point out that I have a number of my Dorsey colleagues immediately behind counsel table who have worked on this case tirelessly with me over the last 5 years. At the time of trial in this federal capital murder case, there was, sitting in the files of a federal government agency's, three reports from federal mental health professionals. Those reports, in the words of Judge Wiener of the Fifth Circuit, the judge who heard the direct appeal and who heard the first habeas appeal, are virtually guaranteed to establish that Mr. Webster is mentally retarded and therefore constitutionally ineligible for the death penalty. The Supreme Court could not have been clearer in the recent Hall case in reaffirming its principle that the mentally retarded, or now as it's called, the intellectually disabled, may not be executed. Under the extraordinary,
where do we find the definition for mentally retarded, or as you indicated now, disabled?
It's the definition is the one that's been accepted by virtually every court, and that is the American Psychiatric Association's definition.
And did they change just recently to adopt it in the description you just gave, the second description?
The standard is essentially the same. They've adapted a new name, but not a new test.
And what is that test?
Test essentially, Your Honor, is mental retardation or intellectual disability is a condition that manifests before the age of 18 that is characterized by an IQ score of between 70 and 75 on a full-scale Wechsler test, and that there are one or more indications of adaptive functioning deficits.
But
did the Fifth Circuit correctly decide that Webster could not bring a successive Section 2255 motion, or do you still maintain that Section 2255 should have provided an avenue of relief here?
Well, Your Honor, I think it could have, and that was the argument we made to the United States Supreme Court, and cert denied. So we're stuck with that at this point. I think, though, it is crystal clear that if the Fifth Circuit is correct, and the Supreme Court has not corrected them, then under the position that the government is taking today, and as the extraordinary circumstances and facts of this case demonstrate, then unless 2255E provides a mechanism, there is no mechanism for a court to consider newly discovered evidence of mental retardation. Now, the Supreme Court has been absolutely clear in saying, again, in the Hall case and in Atkins case, that the mentally retarded may not be executed. There is no reason why Congress would have preferred newly discovered evidence cases going to actual innocence compared to newly discovered evidence cases to mental retardation. The fact of the matter is, at the time that Congress passed AEDPA in 1996, we were still 6 or 7 years away from the Supreme Court's decision in Atkins that the mentally retarded may not be executed.
Could I ask you this question? Of what importance is it to your argument that the evidence that you are relying on was pre-existing, as opposed to, you know, perhaps, you know, you going out and hiring a psychologist to examine Mr. Webster last week, you know, to say that he is indeed intellectually disabled or mentally retarded, as you wish, and thus can't be executed?
I think it's critical, Your Honor. I mean, one of the rationales for AEDPA and one of the concerns of the courts over the years have been sort of endless arguments made based on new experts coming in and new experts saying things. In other words, newly created evidence. And that's not what we're talking here. We're talking.
You're actually making an argument, if I'm understanding you correctly, that because this evidence preceded actually the crime, that its exclusion from the trial undermined the results at the trial?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, we're saying that, Your Honor.
What limits do you think we can place on the claim? In other words, if more doctors perform new tests on Webster and conclude, again, that he is mentally disabled, must he be allowed to bring additional Section 2241 claims? In other words, I guess what I'm getting at is abuse of the writ the only limit here?
Well, again, Your Honor, that's not this case, of course, but to answer your question directly, the framework that this court has established, the overarching framework that this court established in Davenport and Taylor and the other cases that dealt with change of law cases, is whether or not Section 2255H impairs the essential function of habeas corpus. And the essential function of habeas corpus, as this court has articulated it, is, was the prisoner given a reasonable opportunity to obtain a reliable determination of the legality of his conviction or sentence? So it seems to me that that framework, if it's employed, is a limitation.
And what, I would about, argue, the, what about the context of the death penalty? Because, again, I'm concerned about limiting principles. Is it your position that the death penalty is different? And so in terms of 2255E, does it apply just in death penalty cases? Give me some sense of where you're going.
We're certainly not arguing for a broader expansion of or expansion beyond the death penalty context. And we're not arguing for an expansion beyond even the mental retardation intellectual disability context. It is different. It is the Supreme Court has said not only that death is different, but that unlike in many cases, there are at least two classes, status of prisoners, who just may not, flat out, may not be executed. The intellectually disabled are one, and those who commit crimes when they are under the age of 18 are the other. We're not arguing for anything beyond the application of 2255E to somebody claiming newly discovered evidence in the context of mental retardation in a death penalty case.
So if the Supreme Court were to find some other class of people categorically excluded from capital punishment and retroactively apply that, one assumes, they too might fall in your rule.
It's, you know, Your Honor, I'm thinking about what kind of other status or category there might be, and it's hard for me to say, it's hard for me to answer that question, but I guess theoretically it's at least possible.
So I have a question that I'm actually also going to ask counsel for the United States. Toward the end of his brief, on page 49 to be exact, he says that your claim ignores the fact that if you believe that mental retardation renders Webster incompetent to be executed, and I'm quoting, he can raise that claim once an execution date is set and execution is imminent. And he cites Panetti against Quarterman, Ford against Wainwright. So I wonder what your position is on that. That would surely have to be a 2241 case if there were such a case brought, I suppose.
A Ford case is brought under the rubric of 2241, but it's a very different standard. It's the standard about whether or not a prisoner can appreciate essentially why he's being executed. That's not the standard for mental retardation or intellectual disability. It's a completely different standard. That is a red herring.
Why? Sounds like the right standard.
No, that, Your Honor, that would be the that would ignore Atkins and Hall. In other words, Atkins and Hall have said that you are constitutionally ineligible for execution regardless of whether or not you understand why you would be executed. Those are two different standards. You may meet all the standards of intellectual disability. It may have manifested under the age of 18. You may have adaptive functioning deficits. Your IQ may be 55, but you may still be able to appreciate why you were being executed.
So what is you can see the relevance of a low IQ to criminal responsibility, but obviously he's regarded as, you're not quarreling with this, as someone capable of intentional an intentional crime, murder. So if he's capable of that, why would you say he can be convicted of murder but he can't be executed, even though he's sufficiently intelligent to know what it means to be executed and knows why he's being executed?
That question, Your Honor, is respectfully out of our hands. The Supreme Court has said in Atkins.
What's the sense of it?
The sense of it is that
low IQ people can't be executed? Is that what the
sense of it, Your Honor, is there's a number of different reasons why the court laid down this in Atkins. And one of them is that people with intellectual disability at this level have lower moral culpability. Now, this court may agree.
But that should affect the punishments that's imposed at sentencing on the basis of a trial. The trial of guilt shows that this person, because he's mentally retarded, didn't really understand the gravity of what he was doing. That would, you know, you'd think that would lead to a lighter punishment. If he's eligible to be, you know, a first degree murder convict, why is there this additional?
The Supreme Court's reasoning in Atkins, Your Honor, is A, that people who have this level of intellectual functioning have lower moral capability. That's point number one. Point number two that the Supreme Court gave us in Atkins and again in Hall is that defendants who are unable to who have this disability are unable to assist their counsel. Three, they are also more likely to give false confessions. And those are the primary reasons why.
That all involves guilt.
Well, the Supreme
False
Court.
False confessions, obviously. That's about guilt. That's not about being executed.
Well, but again, Your Honor, the Supreme Court has said whether it's about. It can lead to improper convictions. It can lead to things that.
Yes, but we're not talking about convictions.
But the Supreme Court said, maybe took a leap and said categorically ineligible for execution.
That is the law. That's the law that came down in Atkins.
Okay, but what exactly is this leap? Now, you have the IQ. You haven't told us much about these three IQ tests, what they were, how these doctors, psychologists, whatever they were, how they decided that he was mentally retarded. And you haven't said much about also the evidence that his behavior in jail suggests that he's mentally competent.
Well, Your Honor, first off, let me say there were a number of different attacks on the defense's mental retardation defense at trial, and I'll address your question directly. There is an indication. First off, these are three doctors, or mental health professionals at least, two are psychologists, who are in the employ of the federal government, and therefore they were required to
adhere to. Are they employed or are they consultants?
Consulting or employed, but they were doing part of the disability analysis that the Social Security Administration.
The sinus disability, right?
Well, initially, apparently he went in for a sinus disability, not for mental retardation, and apparently it was recognized that his intellectual functioning was at a level that he should be evaluated for something else. He was given one full-scale Wechsler test. He was apparently given another partial test.
What is that? Now, the standard criticism of IQ tests is that, although they try not to, they end up asking you knowledge questions. And a person can be perfectly intelligent, but because of culture or being foreign or poorly educated, doesn't know much. So if questions that show ignorance count in evaluating your IQ, you're getting information which is quite irrelevant to a punishment.
Your Honor, there's been no suggestion in this case that these tests were. I mean, and there's no evidence to suggest that the test was improperly performed. There's
I'm
no affidavit
about
from
improperly
any.
Performed. The best test available may have the limitation. This is related to this adaptive functioning notion. The best test may not reveal the full mental functioning of people who have, say, a cultural deficit. That's why I'm just curious what these psychologists, what are the questions? Is there a transcript of their Examinations of him?
What we've produced are the records that were made available to us, apparently in error, according to the Social Security Administration, when we sought them after a long period of time. What else was in the file? We'll never know.
Well, this but let me ask you that he received a number of different IQ, the full-scale Wechsler test, but he had a number of others, too. And weren't the results pretty consistent across all these different tests?
They were.
Well, how did the test...
Maybe you need to talk about adaptive functioning then, because your opponent dwells quite a bit. He says, well, maybe it was a very low IQ, but his adaptive functioning was higher. And you talked about this a bit in your reply brief. But
yes, sir.
Could I, before you answer that, if I could put that in a little context, I think all of us understand that the only judicial evaluation of your evidence so far was by Judge Wiener in his separate concurrence. But I think the focus on some of the details of your evidence may be most relevant in the event that we were to reverse for a hearing and we would have to tell the district judge what to look for, what standard to apply. And I hope you'll address that as you also address Judge Wood's question.
Yes, I'll try to do that, Your Honor. So Your Honor, I'm sorry, your question again.
Adaptive functioning.
Yes.
There's some evidence. This strikes me as a reverse Hall. You know, in Hall, the court is saying your IQ may be high, but there may be very serious concern about adaptive functioning, and you need to look at the whole picture, just to summarize Hall. In this instance, Mr. Webster's IQ, through all these different tests, is actually quite low. You know, in the 50s, maybe in the 60s, he gets a verbal at 71 at one point. But there might be some indication that his adaptive functioning is higher than you might predict from the IQ test. So I would like to know how we should think about his adaptive functioning in the light of the Hall approach and anything else you'd like to say.
I think it's also important, Your Honor, to understand this in the context of the evidence that was presented at trial. So first, with respect to IQ, I agree. It was consistently low throughout. The government never conceded any of that. And if you read through the trial transcript, they go on for pages about how the defense experts were biased and that Mr. Webster had a bias and a motivation to fake. And they strongly disputed and suggested that the IQ tests were false, point number one. Point number two, with respect to adaptive functioning, there was very strong evidence from all the defense experts about various adaptive functioning deficits that Mr. Webster had. The prosecution had some conflicting evidence about that. What is important, I think, about these new records, the records that were done by the Social Security Administration Agency, is they are, in effect, admissions by the federal government that the level of adaptive functioning that Mr. Webster displayed when he was evaluated by them was sufficient to diagnose him as mental retardation. Now, these are, again, they're experts who are in the employ of the federal government.
They're not in the employ. Look, but I don't see how that's responsive. You haven't said anything. I remember from your briefs that you discussed the evidence about how he functioned in prison, which suggested that he was pretty mentally competent.
Well, the evidence at trial also was that evidence of behavior in the prison environment is very, very weak from a psychiatric standpoint and a psychological standpoint.
I don't understand why.
Because it's a very, very closed environment with very limited stimuli and very limited opportunities to do anything. And therefore, in the prison...
reading a newspaper and asking for change, you know, or you didn't give me the right change at the commissary.
We have an unrebutted expert affidavit on this very point, Your Honor. It's Professor Mark Tessé. It's in our appendix, and he describes at length about why sort of prison behavior and prison environment evidence is not probative.
Well, you don't explain it in your brief.
Well, we cite back to Dr. Tessé's
affidavit.
Well,
that's not good enough for me. What I don't understand, if a person reads a newspaper and if a person asks, you know, knows whether he's getting the right change when he buys a pack of cigarettes or something, why isn't that, you know, germane, just like being asked questions by a psychologist?
Because the definition of mental retardation is that is not that you don't have any functioning whatsoever.
No, but it's if you can read a newspaper and if you can make change and so on, doesn't that have to be looked at together with what the psychologists say?
Oh, I'm not saying it
because,
shouldn't.
Because
I'm not saying
it's a less artificial environment, right? You're with a psychologist. Who knows what they are? But this is your ordinary life, reading, if you were able to read a newspaper. Why wouldn't that be highly germane? I'm not saying it's controlling, but you didn't think it worthy, really, of discussing at all.
Well, no, we described it we relied essentially on Dr. Tessier's affidavit. He's the expert,
I'm talking
Your Honor.
About your brief.
And the American Psychiatric Association
talking about
has
your brief.
Said this.
Maybe it would be helpful if you just listed two or three things out of the record as a whole that suggests bad adaptive functioning.
Well, it's in Hackett's and Spellman's reports, and they talk about his inability to hold a job. He's falling asleep all the time. Could stay in school. Apparently was in special education classes at school. There was very little evidence of functioning. I mean, almost all the things that they catalog are evidence of non-functioning.
I have trouble reading that out of these reports. I'm looking at Hackett's report where he says he's somewhat mildly retarded con man, but very streetwise. I'm having trouble finding in these reports indications of adaptive functioning deficits. In fact, they seem to the contrary.
Well, if you look at, for example, at some of the application materials alone, Your Honor, if you see the lack of comprehension with respect to the questions that are being asked, not just bad handwriting, but total lack of comprehension of what the questions are asking, again and again, doesn't understand what he's being asked. And
is that the opinion the psychologist arrived at after looking at those things?
Yes. According to the records, it is. Now, there may have been more evidence in the file about this, but we'll never know because those records were destroyed by the federal government. There may have been a wealth of other things in there. We just won't know. But what we do know is the records that were produced that weren't spoliated by the federal government agency after we requested them indicates that he didn't understand the questions that he was being asked, that he couldn't hold a job, that he didn't relate well with, didn't interact well with people, didn't seem to understand a lot of the questions that were being asked by the psychologist. We can all kind of read it for ourselves what the psychologist and psychiatrist said.
So let me ask you to do this. I'm concerned about blending too many issues. I mean, the first issue is whether the savings clause of 2255E applies to your case.
Right.
The panel at this court was afraid that you were really just saying, well, if you for some reason can't use regular 2255, you just relabel it as a 2241 and go. So, it is the kind of claim you're making something that properly fits under the savings clause? If it is, what are the things that make this that kind of claim? Maybe it's because it's a categorical prohibition against execution. Maybe it's because it's old evidence. I don't know, but... And then, what kind of a prima facie showing does a person have to present to be able to have this extra round, if you will? I mean, Congress is clearly concerned about people dragging things out too much, and I think we all have the sense that if 2255E were available, if we should find that, there are open questions. Perhaps, does he meet this showing on this record? Factual questions that we're talking about right now, but they might belong a little further down the line.
Well, it seems to me that you're right. The first question is 2255E inadequate? And the answer to that is there a mechanism, is there any mechanism under the statute, under 2255H, for consideration of newly discovered evidence of mental retardation?
Of categorical,
categorical
ineligibility, which goes beyond the statute, I take it, because one of your problems may be
that even at the time of the trial, there was the federal statute that said you shouldn't execute mentally retarded people.
But there wasn't a it was not constitutionally ineligible.
Is there any substantive difference between the statute and the Supreme Court's constitutional decisions?
Well, I'm not both categorically excluded. That's true.
Exactly.
But in
so
this
there's
case,
no substantive difference between the two.
Well, but in this case, there were retroactive statutory decisions before this court decided that the existence of a retroactive statutory decision under 2255.
The statute was enacted in 1994, which was before the trial.
Well, there were. What I'm saying is, this is analogous to the situation in which this court has said,
the situations you're referring to involve retroactive changes in law. That's why I asked the question whether there was a difference between the statute and the Supreme Court's decisions. Unless there's a difference, there's been no change of law at all.
This is not a change of law case. We are not arguing that this is a change of law case. This is a new evidence case. We're arguing that 2555H1 is inadequate, not 2255H2. And, Your Honor, just to touch base on the standard question, the district court, I fully understand the floodgate concern, but first off, this is a very, very unusual and limited circumstance. The facts here really are extraordinary. The district courts, which are the guardians of 2241, are perfectly able to detect frivolous claims. They already have standards to do that. The abuse of the writ concepts still apply. It seems to me that all the questions that Judge Posner has been raising or others are things that the district court ought to be weighing. This is the district court that ought to make the
Mr. Wells, let me go back to my question.
What's the standard?
What do we tell the district court to look for if we remand the case?
Well, Your Honor, I think the standard is the one that's set forth at the end of Section 2243, which is justice and equity. The law as the law law and justice require. Now,
can
is
you
that
be
a
more specific?
Is that a preponderance of the evidence? I would argue for a preponderance of the evidence claim. Has the petitioner demonstrated by a preponderance of the evidence that he's mentally retarded and therefore constitutionally ineligible for the death penalty?
Let me ask you a question. Could you point to the strongest position the government took at trial with regard to the fact that there might be malingering or fakery involved by your client?
Yes, I believe it was Dr. Kuhn's, Your Honor, and I'll find the site when I sit down and have it for you. But he went on for pages about how Mr. Webster was motivated to fake and how this was an artificial
setting. Now let me just follow that up for a second. If the government had not taken that position and just presented evidence as to the mental state of the defendant, if they had not, what you're seeking would be just cumulative, wouldn't it?
Well, I think
you're trying to get evidence in that spoke to an examination prior to crime.
If the government had absolutely conceded that all those IQ tests were valid, that Bruce wasn't faking, then we'd be talking about the other attacks that they made. And we are talking about those other attacks, too. But there was a four-pronged attack here by the government. Mr. Webster was faking. Defense experts were biased. He wasn't in special education classes. And he didn't show adaptive deficits.
Well, I just want to focus on how much of the government's case was that not about the test results, but the fact that he may not have been honest in response. Because it seems to me that's the heart of your case. If the government had not taken the position of that the defendant wasn't accurate in his responses, then all you would be doing is getting some more tests from the Social Security Administration.
No, Your Honor, that wouldn't be, because we'd also be this evidence also addresses those three other prongs of the
government. Well, I appreciate that, but I'm focusing
on the IQ test.
On whether he was a subject who responded to the extent that he could honestly.
If at trial the government had absolutely conceded without qualification that Mr. Webster had an IQ score of whatever.
No, I'm not asking whether they could concede what his score was, but that he wasn't trying to subvert the test. That's my focus. Because if the government's position is that he was trying to subvert it, those are mainly tests with one exception that resulted post the crime, correct?
At trial, yes.
Yes, that's right. So what you're trying to do, it seems to me, I'm not being critical, I'm just trying to see if this is the accurate description, is trying to amass evidence pre the crime, which would have less likelihood of the your petitioner not being responsive.
That's certainly part of it, Your Honor. It's only part of it, but that's
certainly
part of it. Well,
if it isn't part of it, then aren't you just stuck with more new tests, even though they're pre-crime?
No, and I'm not trying to minimize the importance of that. I think it's very important. And I do think the fact that these were the only three pre-crime diagnoses of mental retardation.
Why are you so confident that he had no incentive to exaggerate his disability to the Social Security Administration?
Well, first off,
the worse off he is, the more likely he is to get disability benefits.
A, he was being evaluated for a sinus condition. B, there's an express determination by one of the mental health professionals that he wasn't malingering.
How can they be sure?
It seems to me, Your Honor, that
but here's
that
what you're, here's what
your
problem. I mean, I'm basically sympathetic to the notion that 2241 should have a function here. But the problem is, you come close to arguing, I think, that any time the defendant comes up with something new, it goes to the district court, and the district judge makes a preponderance determination, then it goes up an appeal, and then a year later, because these things drag out so long, there's another such proceeding, right? You don't seem to have any sensitivity to the administrative concern with not stretching these things out indefinitely.
No, Your Honor, I am trying to be sensitive to those concerns because I understand they're very important to the court.
I don't think you are. What would be an example of a case where newly discovered evidence is presented and a court would be entitled to say, this isn't enough of a game changer to make us invoke 2241, which doesn't really quite fit, right?
But that's
that goes back to my original question. You know, why? Of what importance is it that the evidence that you're talking about was already in existence and couldn't be changed or added to, namely these three reports from his pre-crime period? And would you be making the same argument if somebody had tested him in the prison in 2008? That's the scenario of the more and more and more new evidence and coming back every 15 minutes with something.
But under the framework that this court has already established, That isn't an indication that he didn't have a reasonable opportunity to obtain a reliable judicial determination. That's what would preclude that.
Well, what is your answer to Judge Wood? I don't understand.
Well, that's it. The district court would determine whether or not.
So that's out. So you're not arguing for new evidence in the sense of just some additional psychiatric or psychological report. You have to limit your argument because the Social Security consultants or whatever they were, you know, the people on the payroll of the Social Security, had already done their reports, and without that input in the trial, there was a fundamental problem with the trial.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. And that it's in the context of a death penalty case where Congress has been explicit about the unconstitutionality of executing the mentally retarded.
Only these two categories.
Well, but it seems to be
no other question. I mean, your time is up. I will give you a little bit for rebuttal, and I'll make sure that the government has additional time as well. And we'll hear from you, Mr. Hendricks.
May it please the court. Wes Hendricks on behalf of the United States. Three independent considerations undermine Webster's attempt to satisfy the Savings Clause. First, when Congress enacted AEDPA, it barred successive new evidence challenges to the eligibility for the death penalty.
Hard to believe. What if this fellow developed Alzheimer's and he becomes a human vegetable? He has no idea what's going on. You think he can still be executed?
No, I do not. That is a Ford or a Panetti claim that can be brought through 2255 if his circumstances change while he's incarcerated.
You mean when he can no longer understand why they're doing it to him, you can't do it?
Yes, Your Honor. That's
where correct. And what is that? What permits that?
The combined Supreme Court cases of Ford and
Panetti. But where in the statute is that?
Why isn't that a successive 2255?
Because the factual predicate for that only arose after the initial round of 2255 is complete. I mean, second or successive.
Well, that's what he's arguing. Yeah.
That's exactly what he's arguing. I don't see that in 2255. I understand there has to be room for a Ford and Panetti claim because the Supreme Court's been quite clear about that. But successive 2255, a new evidence, successive 2255 that doesn't go to actual innocence of the offense?
A Ford or Panetti claim, I mean, the factual predicate arises. It is not ripe at the time of the initial 2255 because the execution date is not set. But once that execution date is set, if his circumstances has changed, then the new factual predicate has arisen.
Why does the execution date have to be set if he becomes incompetent with Alzheimer's?
That's a question of ripeness. The courts have held that you simply cannot bring that.
Even though he's on death row?
Correct.
That's silly. It puts everything under a pressure cooker that probably doesn't need to be.
You know, there really seem to be open fact questions here. Has any court determined whether this evidence was truly available to Webster at the time of trial or at the time of his first Section 22-5 motion? The ultimate production seems to have occurred under unusual circumstances, really, to say the least. And why not have a court determine whether counsel dropped the ball instead of just assuming that that's what happened here?
The district court judge in this case, on page 11 of the appendix, rejected the idea that it was impossible for Webster to have obtained these documents.
You're talking about the footnote?
Yes.
I mean, he doesn't really clearly rule on that. He says apparently, you know, he's sort of musing.
In addition to that, Your Honor, I recognize that, but in addition to that, the record itself demonstrates that Webster's family, there's no dispute that the trial attorney was aware of these documents, or was aware that he was tested, more accurately.
And they tried to get them. There's a letter.
There's a fax that says, nice talking to you, thanks for the help, I'm going to send an investigator to pick up the documents, I'll have a business records affidavit, so you don't have to come to Texas. I mean, they know it's there, and then the record goes cold. We don't know why they're there. But
And there have been no factual findings about any of those issues, correct?
I'm sorry?
There have been no factual findings about any of those issues, correct?
There's been no factual finding about that issue, but the record here demonstrates that Webster his family told his lawyer he was tested. You should go to Social Security.
Your position, however, is that no relief is available under 2241, even if it were clear that there was no access to this evidence, and even if the evidence showed beyond dispute that Mr. Webster was ineligible for the death penalty, correct?
Not necessarily, no.
What would be the circumstances where he could get relief then?
If there truly were no prior opportunity, I mean, the question in this case is whether 2255 was inadequate or ineffective for Webster. So if the circumstances were changed, and to follow your hypothetical, there was no prior opportunity to present this evidence. He wasn't aware like he was in this case. Then that case gets much closer to Garza, where it's, to use the language from that case, it was literally impossible for him to have brought it previously. And under those circumstances, to analogize to cases like Brown and Garza and Davenport, we're just not going to hold that against someone because they couldn't have brought it in their 2255.
Are you saying if it was truly unavailable to him, then he would be entitled to a hearing?
Possibly. I mean, it would depend on the facts of the case, but if you have no prior opportunity, he certainly has a much better argument that he can analogize to cases like Garza where it's literally impossible. A plain reading of the statute would indicate no, and this court would have to decide congressional intent. Okay, did Congress really intend to limit no prior opportunity type claims, which isn't this case. There was a prior opportunity here. to present this evidence.
Well,
he just didn't make full use of it.
There was. That presents factual disputes that no court has really examined, right? Lord knows how this information was actually produced or why, by mistake, but we know that it was in federal agency files. And even when Webster's counsel got it, the Social Security Administration says it was by mistake. That's very troubling. And it raises the question about just how persistent does counsel have to be? And it seems to then suggest that this case should turn on factual issues that no court has yet examined.
The best evidence of the availability of these documents is that when the Dorsey attorneys requested them, 16 years after they were originally requested, they received them within a matter of months. So years...
That's guesswork. That's just guesswork. I mean, who knows what would have happened, right? If they'd been more persistent, maybe somebody would have invoked whatever rules they thought were broken 16 years later.
And I don't... When they say, you say, by mistake, I mean, the response, they receive some documents. 10 months later, they say, hey, it doesn't appear that we have everything. We'd like more. At that point, they say, the person you originally worked with has since retired. You should have been charged for copies. You should have been asked to go to the district where this person lives now, even if he's in prison. I mean, cold and bureaucratic in federal government, absolutely. But
no, I understand this, but it doesn't really make sense in light of the letter that the Dorsey paralegal sent, which says in the letter, you know, we'll pay for this, you know, send us a bill or, you know, let us know if we need to pay in advance. If they say you have to pay, I mean, it's an oddly non-responsive response, and I just can't see how, if you're willing to concede that if his lawyer back in 1994 tried to get the records, and maybe somebody lazy at the Social Security Administration receives the request, and so they just write back saying, oh, we can't find anything, and so they don't send anything back. If you're willing to concede that that is a situation under which the claim that is now trying to be brought forward under 2241 would be possible because it was a de facto lack of ability to get the records, then I don't know why we don't need to find out if this is that case or if it's a different case where the lawyer just dropped the ball and he should have done it, at which point maybe we do fall back to Panetti and Ford. I'm deeply concerned about executing somebody who's falls within the Atkins Hall rules, but that we can worry about.
For two reasons. Under the circumstances of this case, right, I mean, if we want to limit the question here, the question is, did Webster have a reasonable opportunity through 2255, an unobstructed procedural shot, to use the frank language of Davenport, to test the legality of his detention? He presented five experts related to his mental retardation, his alleged mental retardation at trial and at the sentencing portion. He litigated that during his 2255, and he was aware.
He did litigate it a lot, but there's. I know he's not making a Brady-Kyle point, but we're looking at a situation where there was very material evidence in the custody of the federal government that doesn't get turned over to him. And it would have, I think, changed the ability of the government to say he was malingering or trying to manipulate the results of the IQ tests. And it would have, I mean, there's also this letter about the special education. It would have really undermined quite a bit of the trial strategy.
I disagree. The prosecution team was unaware of the existence of these documents.
But that doesn't matter under Kyle's against Whitley. Now, maybe you're under a different rule, but whether you happen to know or not is usually not material.
The best evidence of the fact that the prosecution team was unaware and that this was within his reach is the fact
and
that...
And this is a mentally retarded guy, actually, by the way. You know, so to say he should have been telling his lawyer all of these things actually runs right into one of the reasons that Atkins said there should be this categorical rule for mentally retarded people.
A district court judge that sat through over 50 witnesses just at the sentencing phase, a trial that went over 25 days, made the considered decision that he was not mentally retarded. That was challenged on appeal and was challenged again in a 2255.
And he didn't have in front of him the pre-crime records that Judge Wiener said virtually guaranteed a finding of mental retardation, correct?
He did not have that. He had substantially similar evidence of that. I mean, the argument that why these things change the game is that they're pre-crime. They're pre-crime evidence. And so he wouldn't malinger to try to escape the consequences of his crime.
He wouldn't lie about special education.
Correct.
That was the government's, one of the major attacks, correct?
About the special education courses?
And about his testimony, his malingering, the reliability of his responses on the tests.
Right. That's why these documents, in their view, are a game changer, because they undermine this idea that he was malingering. But there was evidence of pre-crime diagnosis of mental retardation.
Only one person, right? Wells?
Sorry?
Just one person.
That was the Arkansas report?
Yeah, that was the Arkansas report. And both of two of their experts testified about that and said what this means is that there's a pre-crime diagnosis. Again, and it's even better evidence, really, in these Social Security documents. Because if you go to Social Security and you're seeking a lifetime stream of benefits, I would anticipate that the prosecutor would have stood up and said there's an incentive there as well to malinger.
And the government's experts in those cases are well aware of that incentive and are trained to look for malingering, right?
Yes.
We see a lot of Social Security cases on this.
Absolutely. And the only doctor, I mean, there was some conversation earlier about three IQ tests from these documents. That's inaccurate. Only one test was given. The only doctor that actually gave an IQ test was Dr. Hackett. And that did indicate a low IQ score. But
do you agree, as your opponent does, that the Supreme Court has adopted virtually the test set out by the American Psychiatric Association or whatever it is?
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's whole hog. The Supreme Court said whatever it is, including the numbers of IQ numbers in that test.
Yes. The test to determine mental retardation has not.
So they're absolute, however they're given, they're absolute whatever they are. In other words, a district judge looking at it doesn't have an opportunity to say, well, that can't be something other than what the numbers indicate.
The IQ test you're talking
about.
Yes, a district court judge is going to, I mean, he or she will weigh the evidence.
That's what I'm saying. You weigh it, but at least you're stuck with that, or maybe stuck is a right word, but you're committed to that. That's the only number it can be. It can't be anything else.
Yes. The experts opine about what the result of their test
so
are.
So notwithstanding the fact that there is somewhat the giving of these tests may not be exactly accurate all the time, that is the number that the district court has to live with.
Here there were competing experts, right? I mean, this is.
Well, I understand they're going to be able to give their opinion, and the district judge can evaluate whether or not they thought there was malingering or not malingering or whatever. But when it comes to the IQ test, at least that's set in stone.
And absolutely, and the district court here did weigh that evidence. And really, the IQ test is not what this determination turned on. Both the district court judge explained that in his opinion denying the 2255, and the Fifth Circuit explained that all the experts who testified, including those who testified for the government, acknowledged that Webster has a low IQ. I mean, what this dispute turned on at
well, low
trial,
low doesn't mean low, in this situation it has to be between two particular numbers, right?
Our expert recognized that even the government's test put him within the range of potential.
If he were one number above it, he wouldn't be within this thing that the Supreme Court has accepted. Right?
Well, many of his numbers, as I recall, were well below what the Supreme Court accepts.
That's correct.
Except one or two numbers were right around the margin, and most of them were much lower. But I think what you were starting to say was that the case turned on adaptive functioning. And there I do have a concern with over-reliance on behavior within a prison, which is, to say the least, highly structured. People do what they're told, and just because somebody might know that they get 20... Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, that'd be my desire. But if they got 25 cents change instead of 50 cents change, you know, I'm not sure that tells you that they can function adaptively. We also have evidence of how he functioned at home, which was pretty much doing nothing. He says he sits around and watches TV, and his mother cooks meals for him, and he pretty pretty much doesn't do anything.
Two answers to that. There was an overwhelming amount of evidence of his adaptability outside of the prison context. Inside of the prison context, there was also evidence presented on that to rebut Mr. Webster's experts that went to his family members and said, tell me about him. And they say, he can't make meals, he sits around all day, I mean, everything you just mentioned. Let me start with the former. The government presented testimony of two ex-girlfriends, five school employees, and his former probation officer, all about his conduct outside of the prison setting. They testified that he was a drug dealer, his girlfriend saw him count his own money, he paid his girlfriend's bills at times, they all saw him be deceptive and lie. There was also testimony from their own expert that leadership is extremely inconsistent with mental retardation. That's in the trial record at 24-102. But the evidence, again, outside of the prison setting, was that Mr. Webster was a leader before, during, and after this kidnapping and murder. Before, he was brought in to lead this charge. Also before, when he showed up, he said, I'm going to need gloves. I'm going to need rope. I'm going to need a gun. And when they go to that apartment to stake it out, he's the one that says, if we're going to do this, let's do this. He's the one that goes to the door and knows, I need to be deceptive. So he knocks on the door and he says, FBI, let us in. When she won't let him in, they break the window. He's the one that goes in and drags her out. That's evidence outside of the prison context of adaptability before the kidnapping. But he continued to lead during the kidnapping. During the kidnapping, he's the one that chose and rented the hotel. He filled out the form that was required to rent that hotel room. He is the one that forced Lisa to take a shower. He's the one that left to acquire a comb that he could give her so she could comb out her pubic hair to try to get rid of evidence because they had been raping her. He's the one that chose the murder location. He brought the shovels to do that. He picked up the guys and drove them to the website, drove them to the gravesite. He continued to lead after the murder and kidnapping. He gathered clothes to burn them. And I have citations in the trial record for all of these, should the court want any of them. He's the one that washed the shovels. He created a cover story. He's the only one that could find the grave, which was in a wilderness. That's an overwhelming amount of evidence outside of the prison context of adaptability. So even if this court disagreed with the government that Congress simply did not allow when it passed AEDPA and created a sea change of habeas litigation, and you disagree with our position that these types of new evidence claims that go only to a sentence are disallowed, and you disagree with us that Webster had an adequate opportunity because he had a forum and he was aware of the evidence, he just now wants to put more evidence to support a claim that's already been rejected, and he wants to do that in a different forum. Even if you disagreed with all of that, what standard would you adopt? The standard would have to be at least as exacting as the new evidence standard in 2255H1. I don't see any reason...
What I think, you know, you need to do is think again about what are we trying to do here? You've presented clearly your side on the adaptive functioning issue, and it's not at all clear to me that if he gets, just as the person did in Garza, if he gets to first base and he gets to present this claim, maybe it'll succeed, maybe it won't. You know, maybe this exchange back and forth between IQ testing and adaptive functioning would come out in favor of his capability. I'm not sure I read Atkins and Hall to say that adaptive functioning can completely trump even the lowest of IQ scores. I think it's an interesting legal issue that one would want a good record on. Because, you know, third graders, second graders can do a lot of things. Even first graders can do a lot of things. But as I understand the Supreme Court's decision, somebody who functions at a first grader's level is categorically ineligible to be executed. A
couple of responses to that, Judge. First, the parties do not dispute in this case what the proper standard in determining mental retardation is. And that's a three-part standard.
Right, we've been through that a couple of times.
Okay,
yeah.
All right. To your point about the hearing and issue, shouldn't we have a factual record developed on this? Of course, when you're determining whether someone is categorically ineligible for the death penalty, that is a highly, highly important task. That is part of the reason Congress said it needs to be done at the right time and in the right place. Those rules were clear, they were laid out, and Webster was aware of all of that, and he was aware that this evidence was out there. He just chose not to use it.
Webster might not have been aware. I don't know about his lawyer.
When I say Webster, I mean Webster's legal team. The harm that could result from, hey, you know, why don't we just remand this case? Why don't we just allow a hearing? I point the court to Herrera versus Collins, where an actual innocence claim is made to the Supreme Court. And they were asking for largely the same thing. Look, we have evidence of actual innocence. Why can't we just have a hearing? Well, one...
But the court didn't find in the end in Herrera that the evidence was all that compelling. That's where they have the intriguing paragraph saying, well, we haven't really addressed freestanding actual innocence, but we don't have to run that to the ground here because it's not shown.
What Herrera did explain was the practical difficulty that would result from a hearing many years after the crime. This crime occurred over 20 years ago.
What happened to the other two? The other two murderers.
Orlando Hall also received the death penalty.
Has he been executed?
No, he's still incarcerated. The others received substantially longer sentences.
But not
life and not the death penalty. They cooperated. They testified against both Webster and Orlando
Hall.
Do you
recognize any category or situation in which newly discovered evidence would be basis for a new hearing? Even if, for example, it was evidence that the defendant's lawyer should have discovered years earlier but didn't.
If the circumstance were that there was just simply no prior opportunity and the evidence...
No. I want to look at the case where the first lawyer botched it, but nevertheless, later, years later, compelling... evidence of, you know, ineligibility for the death penalty has emerged. Is that absolutely barred, or if it were really conclusive?
Now, in that circumstance, where the trial, I want to make sure I understand the hypothetical, the trial lawyer botched it.
Yes.
Years later, this evidence is discovered. 2255 envisions that circumstance. It's not inadequate. Both 2255 F2 and F4 say your limitations period runs from the time that you discover or could reasonably discover this factual basis, and it would be the first...
Factual basis for what, though? I mean, suppose, to build on Judge Posner's hypothetical, the person who commits the murder is in fact, but nobody finds this out, 17 at the time he did it. But maybe they're an illegal alien or something like that. And it's only many years later that a lawyer digs down to birth records in Guatemala, you know, and finds out that, in fact, at the time the person committed the murder, he was only 17. So that's a different type of categorical ineligibility. I don't see how that changes the fact that the person committed the murder, that this is nothing that would show actual innocence of the offense. This is really just a different form of categorical ineligibility for the penalty. And so if I'm understanding your argument, at least in your brief, you say execute them anyway because they found out too late.
No. Our brief points out a couple things, and I have a few things to add. First, as explained in Herrera, the traditional remedy where all judicial forms really are closed for whatever reason, and we have truly an extraordinary circumstance with objective evidence of ineligibility, which mental retardation and age, I understand they're both categorical exclusions, but they are very different. I mean, we have 7 experts that testified about this, and this is a highly trained judgment call. Age is objective, and it's different. But nonetheless, first, clemency is the traditional answer when all doors to the courthouse have been used and simply Congress doesn't allow them to be open anymore. That's Herrera versus Collins. As I anticipated a question like that, another case that occurred to me for extraordinary circumstance, extraordinary remedy, which, again, the government does not believe is this case, is the Troy Davis case from the Supreme Court in 2009.
I'm very familiar with the Troy Davis case, and that was an original habeas corpus petition at the Supreme Court where there's a hearing that is more or less in assistance of the Supreme Court's jurisdiction.
Yeah, the original writ filed in that circumstance. Look, I can't file a 2255. Apparently the determination was made the savings clause is unavailable to me. I'm going to file an original writ in the Supreme Court. Extraordinary case. The Supreme Court ordered the district court to conduct an evidentiary hearing and
but
make findings.
I don't think the Troy Davis case would fit within 2255E. It was just a case of lots of witnesses who recanted their eyewitness identifications of Mr. Davis, which I think is actually quite different from the present case. There was no categorical issue.
I agree with you that in this case, he's had his opportunity. He was aware of the evidence.
No, in Troy Davis' case is what I was saying, not this case. This case we're trying to decide. But in Troy Davis's case, there's no way that 2255E would have applied.
And the Supreme Court stepped in that extraordinary circumstance and ordered the district court to conduct a hearing.
Would that also apply? Would that also apply?
Judge Wood asked you about the lazy sort of the lazy Social Security person. What if we had a situation where the government intentionally suppressed evidence, the defendant was mentally retarded, and fabricated evidence that the defendant was not mentally retarded? And then years later, the government discloses this information because it had its experts lie about the person's IQ. Would the defendant be able then to use the savings clause, even though he's only seeking to challenge his eligibility for the death penalty based on newly discovered evidence?
He would need the savings clause in that circumstance because 2255 would be open to him in that circumstance. That would be a new factual predicate that was withheld from him by the government and only later disclosed, and it was impossible for him to have raised it earlier. And so 2255 F2 and F4 create a new limitations period, and second or successive is a term of art, of course. It doesn't just mean the second 2255 that you filed. When the factual predicate for your 2255 argument was not in existence at the time of your initial 2255, you can file another one. And in that circumstance, he would need the savings clause. 2255 is built to address that circumstance. That's not our circumstance.
Judge Hamilton had a question.
That was exactly the question that I was going to ask.
Okay.
Two birds.
I'm not sure I'm convinced by the response, though, because in terms of distinguishing this case, where the government had the evidence, it was not an entirely new issue. But, again, we have Judge Wiener characterizing it so powerfully. The defense tries to get it, is unsuccessful. Are you saying that he ought to just file a new 2255 petition at this point?
In this case, he cannot. Because he had a prior opportunity, he was aware of that. He was aware of those documents at the time, and for whatever reason, either apparently didn't follow through or didn't use those documents. And a reasonable extrapolation as to why he would do that is because he had substantially similar evidence without the baggage of Social Security. Because remember, the end of this Social Security story is that disability benefits were denied. And to go to the point of, you know, he just showed up for, you know, an alleged disability because of his sinus problems, right? Well, that was in his initial document. But later, he tells Dr. Spellman that he thinks he's disabled because he's a slow learner. And in a motion for reconsideration, he claims to be disabled also because he's a slow learner. That's in separate appendix 354 and 404. So it's not as though he had no incentive to malinger because he's there for a sinus condition and, hey, I would never try to malinger whether I'm mentally disabled.
I'm still disturbed at the lack of clarity, though, about why those records are not produced in response to counsel's request for them.
We just
don't know. You think you know that counsel just sat on it and they didn't produce them, and for some reason they just didn't do it. But we just don't know, do we?
Well, at this point, 20 years after the crime, 18 years after the trial, we are limited to the record. And the record does not give an indication that it's request for production, request denied. That's not it. It's,
I understand.
Thank you for talking to me. We're on our way. And then the record goes cold. We don't know what happens after that. But what we do know is that they're aware that those documents are there, and ultimately they don't use them at trial. And again, perhaps they don't use them because they have five experts saying this. His low IQ is largely uncontested,
The records are there, but of course the records don't turn out to be there when the Dorsey firms make their follow-up request. We don't even know when they were destroyed, do we?
We don't know when they're destroyed. And they assume...
Maybe they weren't there.
And they assume that I heard the word spoliation, which is disappointing. There's nothing in the record to indicate that the Social Security Office, after they got this request, said, hurry, we have to shred these documents. Absolutely nothing in the record to indicate that. This is a very old file. They produced what they had when they received the initial request. 10 months later, they asked for more. Again, they're given this federal bureaucratic response of you have the wrong office and you need to use a different form. And once they do that, they say, we have no further records. The records that you're requesting, the additional records, have been destroyed. But we don't know when they were destroyed. But again, it's important to note that everything in these records, which supposedly changed the game now, everything in those records, all the observations, were included at trial in one form or another. I mean, his bad sentence.
That's true, except for the point that Judge Hamilton has been making, in that it gives a very different texture to the trial record if it turns out he's telling the truth about special education classes. The government would have had to proceed somewhat differently. And if it turns out that for a long time, you know, or at least for some time before, and of course you're conceding that the onset of the mental disability is before the age of 18. So he's had this condition since well before he committed this terrible murder that he committed.
A district court judge has determined that he does not have this condition.
But the district court judge is not denying that the IQ is that low and is making assumptions about adaptive behavior that may or may not be correct. The folks who assessed him think not.
They're not assumptions about adaptive functioning. It was a considered, highly case-specific factual determination made by this district court judge based on 28 days of trial, 5,000 pages of records, 53 sentencing witnesses. And he determined
So you think then that my first grader, my six-year-old, who does something deliberately awful, goes and sets a house on fire or does something terrible, should be held criminally responsible because he knew he was setting a house on fire and just thought it'd be fun to watch it burn down?
Of course not. Of course not. There's never been a dispute in this case that he's incompetent.
Of course not, because, I mean, you're saying he does all these things deliberately to commit the crime, which I understand he did, but you're equating that to a certain mental age, and I'm not sure that that's...
I would suggest we add to that he went out and bought the kerosene, bought the matches, set it up, poured the kerosene on the front porch, lighted the matches, told his people to go. Other than that, the analogy is complete.
Before you have to go, I'd like to go back to something that Judge Wood asked Mr. Wells, and that is your claim on page 49 of the red brief, because I found it perplexing. You seem to concede that Webster may bring a Section 2241 claim based on mental retardation once his execution date is set and his execution is imminent, but somehow he may not bring one now. Do you expect that a mentally retarded person's condition may improve enough to render him eligible for execution? I mean, I'd really be very appreciative if you could explain this argument further.
It's two, mental retardation and incompetence to be executed are two separate things, and that goes back to the Ford and the Panetti, and it was an attempt to try to respond that there's no judicial forum to raise any issue related to his mental competency. And there is. If he believes that aside from the issue of mental retardation, so it's not a 2241 claiming mental retardation, it's a 2255 under Ford and Panetti. Panetti is a 2254 case, the state equivalent of 2255, of course. So it's a 2255 claiming he doesn't understand the punishment that's about to occur, and therefore you cannot execute him.
So, but you say mental retardation renders him incompetent to be executed. So you mean he can be executed in violation of Adkins, but he can't be executed in violation of Panetti.
He cannot be executed in violation of Adkins. There is a presumption of validity that applies to this judgment now. The only determination is that he is not mentally retarded. He is eligible for the death penalty. This is not an unconstitutional execution. If If that truly extraordinary case arose where we have something where there is no prior opportunity to present just rock-solid evidence, which we don't think this is, we don't think it comes close to that given the record that we have, then there might be an extraordinary remedy available, either through the Savings Clause or through the Supreme Court.
It would be 2241.
I'm sorry?
It would be 2241.
Or potentially through 2241. But in this case, nothing about 2255 is broken. Nothing about the statute was inadequate. He had a forum to raise this claim. He was aware of these documents, and he didn't raise it. Under those circumstances, it cannot be that the statute is broken. There is no glitch. And in any event, Congress spoke specifically to new evidence claims, and it limited them to new evidence of innocence of your offense. It excluded them. Could Congress have written the statute differently?
But Congress also in H2 spoke specifically to changes in the law, and we've found in Davenport and in Brown and other cases that there are some changes in the law that don't happen to fit under H2 that can be pursued. So I don't know why there couldn't, in principle, be some new evidence claims that, for whatever reason, and that's what we're trying to explore, don't fit in H1 but nonetheless fall under the Savings Clause. That's really another way of phrasing the issue.
The distinction between the retroactive statutory decisions and new evidence rendering you ineligible for a sentence or for the death penalty is that Congress spoke specifically about successive new evidence claims. It did not speak specifically about statutory claims, retroactive statutory decisions. I mean, the true perfect analogy is if Congress had said, we're going to allow some retroactive statutory decisions, but not others. And that's what they've done with
H1. They said some legal claims, namely constitutional ones, and they didn't mention statutory claims. But anyway, why don't you, if you'd like to leave us with some thought, you can wrap up your argument.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. The statute could have been written in many ways. Congress faced an overwhelming amount of successive and abusive litigation, and that's why they did make a dramatic change. It is dramatic, and that was Congress's choice to make, and Congress excludes this type of claim. Even focusing on the record here, there can be no doubt that Webster's chance was not inadequate or ineffective because nothing was unavailable to him like something was unavailable to Brown, Garza, and Davenport. And finally, even if this court were to open the door, you can still affirm because the record shows that he cannot show by clear and convincing evidence that no rational fact finder would have found him ineligible for the death penalty. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Wells, I'll give you 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just wanted to address 3 points. First, with respect to the issue of availability. Clearly, that is an issue of fact. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Number one, I want to point out something, though.
What is it you envision if we were to reverse? Are you asking would there be a new trial in the Southern District of Indiana or some kind of hearings?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, no, that's two different things. Do you just want to have a hearing before a district judge who would make a judgment as to whether this merited a trial, or do you want us to order that there be a new trial of his eligibility for death penalty?
Our request, Your Honor, is that there be an evidentiary hearing with respect to the issue of mental retardation.
Was that trial?
That's a trial that would be summarily decided by the court.
Why summarily?
Because that's what 2243 says, Your Honor.
Well, I don't understand. Don't you have to bring in all the evidence, all these zillions of reports and...
The judge, he or she, would be able to hear the evidence that wasn't presented before and consider it in light of the evidence that was presented at trial and make a determination.
Why wouldn't you just want on the issue of the punishment? Mental retardation didn't preclude him being tried, right?
No, we're not saying he's going to retry guilt or innocence. No, it would simply be on mental retardation.
But when you say summary, you mean just the punishment and just a judge, no juries, no
right.
Fancies.
That's under 2243, well, I think that's...
It was
that's
not clear in your response.
Yeah, no, it was not.
Oh, I'm sorry, I misspoke. I'm saying that I think what is prescribed here under Section 2243 is what I described, which is a summary proceeding. It's called a hearing, but certainly evidence is presented, and it's summarily decided by the court. So just my points on availability issue here, Your Honor, I just, and the court, I just want to make it clear There was no evidence in any record that anybody on the defense side, except perhaps for Mr. Webster himself, knew that he had been tested for mental retardation or knew what was in the records, number one. And all this about whether or not, you know, they did, the government's whole claim here is that he didn't follow up. That's pure speculation. There is nothing in the record to contradict the testimony, the sworn testimony of Mr. Moore, that he took, quote, any and all efforts to track down any information with respect to mental retardation. And with respect to the issue of spoliation, that's exactly what happened here. We know exactly the time period during which these records were destroyed by the Social Security Administration because they produced a partial file to us. And then when we followed up, we got the runaround for months, and then they told us that the entire file had been destroyed. So it was spoliation. Now, what the prosecution knew about that, what the U.S. Attorney's Office knows about that, we don't know. But there was spoliation. On the adaptive functioning point, I want to make this clear, too, and I didn't mention this in my opening remarks, and that is there were standards that the Social Security Administration psychologists and physicians were required to follow in determining whether somebody was mentally retarded in the context of a disability analysis. We've cited the textbook that they were required to follow. Now, it may be that not every one of their diagnoses and their observations about adaptive functioning are in those records, but they were required to follow those procedures. And their determination establishes that pre-crime, again, without motivation to avoid the death penalty, that pre-crime, the evidence with respect to adaptive functioning was recognized by the federal government as being sufficient to establish mental retardation. That was not something that ever came out at trial. Every defense expert was challenged at trial on the issue of bias and on the grounds of bias. That could not have been an attack lodged at Social Security Administration doctors. Let me just leave with this, if I may. Unlike the Fifth Circuit, because of Section 2255E, this court is not required to turn a blind eye and to condone an unconstitutional execution. We submit that this case should be sent back to the district court and should be evaluated, the evidence that both we uncovered and that was available at trial should be considered by the district court in a full evidentiary hearing and a determination made as to whether or not this situation presents an unconstitutional, a situation where somebody who is constitutionally ineligible for the death penalty has been sentenced to death. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks to the government as well. The court will take the case under advisement.